Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
How are you holding up?
What is it, the John McCain quote? After I lost, I slept like a baby. I woke up every 2 hours screaming and crying. That's kind of the vibe.
You told me before we got on that you did not watch the full CNN town hall, right?
Yes, I feel like in order for us to really kind of capture the average viewer, one of us should watch these things and one of us should avoid it as much as we may want to watch it. Resist that temptation and just watch the clips and then get a sense of what the average voter is getting.
I'm just curious if you saw the voter who was essentially a Matt Lewis voter.
No, I'll tell you what I saw and heard. I heard that there were so-called undecided voters who were liberal college professors at this undecided voter town hall. I did not see this Matt Lewis guy. Must have been a handsome sort of devil may care swashbuckler. What was he like?
He said that I'm not quoting, but basically that he was pro-life and that was a very fundamental issue for him, but he was not a fan of, you know, how Trump handled January 6th and his general character. I forget exactly what he phrased the question he put to Harris, but it was essentially, why are you only talking about, you know, sort of the woman, not talking about, you know, the baby, you know, we're talking about these things. And
valid.
You know, Harris didn't say anything different than what she usually says. When, you know, she always tries to, she has a formulation where she's trying not to say, well, we're not surpassing judging anyone for their faith, but just that the government shouldn't be involved in this decision. And she approached him after the event. And they had some additional chatter that the CNN mics picked up part of.
Please. Do you mind turning around? We'll just do a photo with Kelton.
Thank you for that. Yeah. And you know how I feel. This is the thing about the point on abortion. This is not a conversion, right? It's literally no one should be judged on any level. And the it's just my point is the government shouldn't be telling people. It is not about ever disputing or criticizing anyone's faith.
It didn't necessarily, you know, go all that much deeper, but it was a civil exchange. And then there was a CNN discussion with five of the participants afterwards, of which he was one of them. And he didn't say he had become a decided voter in either direction. He was still as conflicted, but he did say he appreciated that Kamala came over and, you know, and had a discussion about it.
Well, this is an issue, too, that Liz Cheney very recently, maybe yesterday, very recently, has addressed.
I think there are many of us around the country who have been pro-life, but who have watched what's going on in our states since the Dobbs decision and have watched state legislatures put in place laws that are resulting in women not getting the care they need. And so I think this is not an issue that we're seeing break down across party lines, right. But I think we're seeing people come together to say what has happened to women when women are facing situations where they can't get the care they need, where in places like Texas, for example, the Attorney General is talking about suing to get access to women's medical records. That's not sustainable for us as a country, and it has to change.
Saying that Liz Cheney saying she is pro-life, mm-hmm. but she's still supporting Kamala Harris, and that you can be pro-life mm-hmm. and support Kamala Harris. So obviously this is an issue as we enter into the final stretch, the home stretch of this election where they're trying to close the deal. This is part of the deal that still needs closing.
I think there's all different flavors of undecided voters. Now you're being a little sarcastic about these undecided college professors, but they may be undecided between Jill Stein or Kamala or Cornel West and Kamala or staying home in Kamala. I think they still count as undecideds. And that's sort of the point. There's all different flavors of undecided. There's no unifying connective a viewpoint that unites the undecided. And so there's different things you have to try to do to try to pull those people over. And there's an argument that maybe it's a giant waste of time because they're all over the map. There is no perfect way to appeal to all of them. But you are seeing Harris, and I think to some extent, Trump here, to a lesser extent, but you know, last night, Donald Trump was talking about taking toxins out of food and making America healthy again, which clearly is a play for new agey RFK Jr. types.
By the way, let me just say, I am into this to a certain degree. I am, to a certain degree, a believer in this. Now, it's ironic that he eats nothing but McDonald's and Diet Coke.
You know this is so phony. Yeah. If Michelle Obama was giving this speech, Donald should be the first one saying racist, sexist things about Michelle Obama, how she wants to take away your McDonald's. It's such nonsense.
They did this. Remember, she grew like arugula or something.
Of course.
And was mocked and destroyed. So, but I do think I think there is something here. I do think that there is a growing sense, and I think this it's shelf stable food. It's food that is
Donald Trump going to do about? Is he going to ban shelf stable foods? Let's be serious here.
Nor should he. But I do think.
Is there going to be a tax incentive? Is he going to have higher taxes? Is there a soda tax like Mike Bloomberg?
He's not going to do jack, okay?
Thank you.
The point I'm making is that I think RFK Jr. is a crank. I think the anti-vax stuff is very dangerous. And I think he's basically a left-wing nut job. But I do think that there are topics that are starting to bubble up that used to be seen as kind of fringy, crunchy topics having to do with health, microplastics, food, that are becoming more mainstream. And I do think now, look, we can't go all Marianne Williamson and that's too far. But I think that it's probably a good thing that these issues are bubbling up and that there will be some side of the political aisle who's going to make this part of their message, and whoever does that, I think will have an advantage with a certain demographic.
Well, just not to go too far down this rabbit hole. I mean, the point I was trying to make is, I think both candidates realize to some degree that there are different pockets of undecided voters to appeal to. No one has it in the bag. I mean, there's definitely this Trumpism with Trumpers lately, based on early voting numbers. But just as you might say, well, why is Kamala talking about a black male agenda if she thinks she's winning? Obviously, she's behind. Okay, clearly there's an anxiety there. Trump would not be talking about taking toxins out of foods if he thought this was in the bag. So he's never talked about it his entire life. So they both are running a little scared, even if their body language is a little different.
Well, let me explain to our viewers and listeners. I think part of the reason we're freaked out, that people are freaked out, we have never been at this point in an election where it looked like Donald Trump was going to win. In 2016, most people thought Hillary, at this point in 2016, most people thought Hillary was going to win.
Well, this is the closest the polls have ever been with Trump on the ballot.
At this point in 2020, most people thought Joe Biden was going to win. And so, as you've just stated it, Trump may lose. But at this point in the race, this is the most reason that there has been for people who follow polling to be concerned.
Oh, sure. And what we don't know, does this mean that Trump is as popular as he's ever been, which is an argument you do see people make just based on a plain reading of the data, or have the pollsters changed their methodology to try to capture more Trump voters than in the past, and therefore maybe you're getting some little maybe more accurate, but not really all that different from past years. And we know not. So I have an article up today at the Washington Monthly about the things that we don't know, the three big things that we don't know, particularly when you're tracking these early vote numbers that have partisan data embedded in them, which is, I believe, Nevada, North Carolina, Arizona, Pennsylvania. We don't know the rate of partisan defection. We don't know how many Republicans vote Harris, how many Democrats vote Trump. It's not something that has been constant election to election. And we don't know how independence will break, something else that has that changes probably more significantly than partisan defection rate. And we don't know how the rates of early voting versus election day voting are going to be different this year than recent years. So we are seeing more Republicans vote early than we have. Does that mean this is a huge Republican blowout, or does it mean that Republicans who used to vote election day have moved up their calendar and it's going to be kind of zero sum? That's all stuff that we don't know.
These are the known unknowns.
Yes.
There may also be unknown unknowns.
Fair enough. because the poll and the polling not only shows essentially a dead even race nationally and in every swing state, if you dig into those polls and try to determine, okay, can I get a sense of what the defection rate's going to be, the cross-party defection rate? Can I get a sense of how the independents are breaking? Not really. I mean, I'd say both those things, you look at the totality of October polling, both those things lean Harris's way, but the range that you see in these polls is enormous. And of course, things were looking like in early October might be different in late October. The polling this week, I'd say, has been a tick more favorable to Trump. But maybe that won't be the case next week. You know, Mitt Romney's polling in this week of October was pretty darn good, but did not hold up for Election Day. So there's reason to be anxious. There's not reason to feel certainty.
So I read a New York Times piece about the town hall, the CNN town hall, and one of the things they said is that Kamala Harris gave these meandering answers that didn't answer a lot of questions, and there was a lot of word salad and grandiose language, Kamala being Kamala, the stereotype about her. And one of the things I've noticed is even outlets like CNN, like I saw someone criticizing Dana Bash, her punditry, and basically saying, hey, who do you want to win? It seems like mainstream media is really going out of their way to try to not put their thumb on the scales, which we could applaud as being good journalism, unbiased. But also, it's like, hey, Trump isn't even doing these town halls, and she subjects herself to it, and then you criticize her, you're going to help elect this authoritarian.
So, now, did you see any of the post town hall discussion on CNN or just a few clips?
Just the clips. And by the way, let me just say that Van Jones once again coming through with the "if the glove don't fit, you must acquit" pithy, comebacks. But
look, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are not taking the same exam.
Yeah,
and I think it bothers people. They're not taking the same exam. He gets to be lawless. She has to be flawless.
Trump gets to be lawless. Kamala has to be flawless, which I did think was a great summation of where we're at. But I want to give you some more context here, because I did watch most of the after game. So you had a lot of pundit roundtable immediately after the event, but you also had this discussion with five of the attendees that John King led after the event. And I'm not a Dana Bash hater. I think she's done a lot of great stuff over the course of this election, but for whatever reason, she came out right away with that comment, that came out right away saying that it felt like voters, that she didn't close the deal.
Well, I'll just tell you what I'm hearing from people who I've been talking to. And that is that if her goal was to close the deal, they're not sure she did that. And, some people have asked, is she being held to a different standard? Maybe. But that's maybe the world that she's living in. And
so the ensuing pundit discussion was kind of premised on that. There was a range of opinion, where Van Jones was being more charitable. And I think it was David Urban was the Republican guy, being very harsh. And some discussion about double standards. And some of it was there shouldn't be double standards. Some of it was, well, there is, and that's just sort of the way Kamala has to accept it because life's unfair. And then you had the attendee discussion, And the vibe was totally different among, it was just five of them. It wasn't everybody. And it wasn't like they were devoid of criticisms. It wasn't like they had, there was mention of Kamala skirting certain questions. But I'd say the totality of it was appreciation that she was engaging. I mean, one in particular was striking, because there was criticism in the pundit roundtable how Kamala answered the classic question, "What's your biggest weakness?" And she gave too much.
I worked too hard.
I mean, it was a little like that. It was definitely kind of meandering, but it kind of came down to, you know, I keep a big team of people to give me lots of advice before I make a decision. So it's like a little bit of like she wouldn't come out right and say, you know, I deliberate too much. I'm slow to come to a conclusion kind of thing. For slight digression, I mean, one of the reasons why I think she does give these quote unquote word salad answers at times is she is being extra careful not to say something that wasn't planned in advance, that can't be clipped out of context, that can't be put into an ad. I mean, the one time where she made that mistake on The View about what would you do than Joe Biden, that's what's in ads right now. But it's literally the one time. It's like everything else is, I mean, you might complain about it being meandering, but she's not making that mistake.
Although Biden did make that mistake. He recently said that we got to lock up Trump or something.
But then he corrected it, which at least sort of mitigated it.
I know.
But anyway, so the pundits were being kind of harsh about the way she handled that question, which is sort of inherently a terrible question. There's no great way to answer that question. And whereas the attendees, at least two of them who spoke, was like, yeah, I really appreciate that, because I really do want somebody who doesn't think they have all the answers. I really want somebody who, really casts a wide net for different opinions. And so it really just showed to me a big disconnect between the way regular people would see it. And a lot of stuff is Rorschach test, which are lots of, hardcore Republicans or people who just have sexist inclinations will look at that stuff in a negative way. So I'm not saying people will look at this in a uniform way. But these were, I think, genuinely undecided people, some who came in as Harris leaners and some as Trump leaners. But at the end of the conversation, it was five of them. You had two people. You ended up with three people saying, "I'm going to vote Harris," one of whom was a 2020 Trump voter. And none of them said, "Okay, I'm with Trump now." And one of the people who were not in that three was the Matt Lewis guy, the pro-life guy, who just seemed genuinely conflicted still. I don't necessarily think that, so you characterize what the New York Times characterized it, which I think is going to be the way a lot of media characterize it, and certainly the way a lot of Trump people are going to characterize it. And I'm not even going as far as saying this is going to be some great game changer that could give Harris 3 points or anything. But I do think this notion that the more you see Harris, the less you like her, I don't think that's true. I think she actually performs relatively well. The problem is that most people aren't going to see an hour-long block of Harris. They're going to see clips, and clips might not necessarily give you that full context. But I do think Harris does herself well by putting herself out there and not hiding in a bubble.
I think there's a whole media debate discussion to be had here, but we can save that for another day. You mentioned sexism. I want to ask you about this. I think it was Shirley Chisholm who said that being a woman was harder than being African-American in politics. And I remember this has been like 6 months or a year ago, even. It's been a while. But Sarah Longwell's focus group podcast, there were a long time ago. I remember hearing these voters admitting that they just wouldn't vote for women, that they just, even women voters, saying that, just surprising me by being how outspoken. If anyone knows what I'm talking about and can actually give me the link, I'd love to hear it again to make sure my recollection is accurate. But I'm wondering, to the extent that Kamala Harris may be underperforming with African-American men, Hispanic men, how problematic is this sexism going to be? And could that be the decisive factor in this race?
I mean, we can't say how much yet until votes are counted. We have anecdotal evidence. If she is doing weaker, if you see a gender gap that didn't exist before, every Trump election's had a big gender gap. So, you know, and I've written about this. I'm doing a gender gap tracker at the Washington Monthly. But Biden had less of a gap than Hillary. Hillary did worse with men than Joe Biden. The women number was pretty much the same. So you already have some initial evidence there. But then you might say, well, look, it's Hillary. Hillary had all this baggage. She had been a lightning rod for decades. She had the whole email thing, the Comey letter. There's a basket of deplorables. There's lots of things that are negative about Hillary that maybe aren't really gender. So let's not pin it all on that. Okay. Kamala Harris, to my eye, has performed as a candidate as good as almost any candidate can perform. Any criticism that I've heard of Kamala Harris that doesn't answer questions directly, meandering word salads, yeah. You can find plenty of male politicians that have done the same things. Yeah.
Stu Stevens, for what it's worth, Romney's 2012 campaign manager or strategist, said that Harris has run the best political campaign in modern history, something like that.
I mean, I don't screw that. Now, I can find quibbles. I'm not saying it's no one's perfect. But I mean, there are criticisms you can make of Kamala Harris that apply 100-fold to Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump is not a straight answer kind of guy. Plenty of meandering, plenty of question dodging.
It's called weaving.
Right. So I think objectively, there are people like a Scott Jennings, for example, who are professionally applying a double standard, you know, but maybe not doing it because he's a sexist, but doing it because it serves his interest to elect his candidates, to elect the candidate of his party. But if we find that that's trickling down to voters who might have otherwise voted Democratic and are not this time, then you might say, yeah, sexism played a big role there. But it's not done yet.
No, but let me just say, this is one of my worries. And if Harris loses, I will suspect that this was a contributing factor for sure.
If she loses, I'm pretty sure I'm going to be right there. But I'm of the view that it's not in a candidate's interest to complain about that.
No, you can't.
Harris does not do that. She didn't ask that question directly and she doesn't go anywhere near it. But if you're going to be a barrier breaker, you can't go in saying, here's all the reasons why life is unfair and I'm going to lose. You have to go into it saying, okay, life is unfair. How am I going to overcome these unfair standards?
And Trump is really exploiting this too, right? I mean, if Kamala Harris was running against Mitt Romney or John McCain, I doubt if it would be as bad. But Trump is trying to expand the electorate to bring in the types of people who are looking for the machismo and the super masculine type of candidate. And he is also saying and doing things to cast her as like a weak woman. He is exploiting this in a way that I think a normal Republican would not do either, out of conscience or out of just the sense that it would backfire. But Trump has no concerns about that.
Well, anybody can be sexist. Anybody can be racist. Women can have internalized sexism. You can be a person of color and have racist beliefs. You know, no one's immune to that. That's kind of negativity. If Donald Trump can win by going on, you know, almost all of his media choices are male centric. He's on a slew of Manoverse podcasts, and you know, Hulk Hogan and Kid Rock and that UFC guy at his convention. When he does talk to women, it's in very paternalistic terms. I will be your protector kind of stuff. If that works, that actually works. Again, that only adds to the argument that, that sexism was a major contributor here. Now, it is still very possible that Donald Trump loses. And these are all very bad decisions that he made. And women are going to vote for Kamala in droves. And there are enough men out there who aren't living in the 1950s saying, don't treat me like I'm a lunkhead. Yeah. So I'm not trying to like do a postmortem yet, because I would, if you ask me today who's going to win, I'm still going to say Kamala Harris. Narrowly, but I would still say that.
I'm getting cold feet on that prediction. I'm not so sure anymore.
Predictions are next week.
One of the reasons it's, are we, do you want to do, I last week I was egging you on, saying that we should do our map, you know, our electoral map, and make our predictions. I feel now so much anxiety about this, and also just the sense that it's so close that I mean, I'll do it if you want to do it, but it's going to be like throwing darts at, like, you know, Pennsylvania for me.
Well, it's always for entertainment purposes only. So I think okay. We can still do it, and with all normal caveats.
Okay. All right. One of the problems, one of the reasons people are nervous, is that Donald Trump has effectively, his closing argument in this race is Arnold Palmer has a big dick. And I want to take away the licenses of CBS. And I want to use the military to go after the Pelosi's and Adam Schiff. And I mean, he's not closing. It's not a kinder, gentler, let's try to fool them into thinking I'm nice. He is going full on fascist.
And I think this is different than 2016. I
mean, in 2016, he went dark, actually, and was on his best behavior. And he was off Twitter, essentially. And now he's letting his freak flag fly. And since I'm using the F word, and since I use the F word, let me play this clip, Bill. So this is from that town hall that we've been talking about. And here goes.
You've quoted General Milley calling Donald Trump a fascist. You yourself have not used that word to describe him. Let me ask you tonight, do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And I also believe that the people who know him best on this subject should be trusted. Again, look at their careers. These are not people, with the exception, I think, of only Mike Pence. These were not politicians. These are career people who have served in the highest roles in national security, who have served as generals in our military, who are highly respected. Talking about the person who would be commander-in-chief.
My whole life, people have been calling everybody, you know, George Bush is a fascist. Mitt Romney's a fascist. I mean, we wantonly throw that word around. So this interview with John Kelly, I think it's the New York Times talking to John Kelly.
Yeah.
He was the former general, former, I think, Secretary of Defense, longest serving chief of staff for Donald Trump. And he was asked if Donald Trump is a fascist. This is what he had to say.
What do you think? Do you think he's a fascist?
Well, I'm looking at the definition of fascism. It's a far-right, authoritarian, ultra-nationalist political ideology and movement characterized by a dictatorial leader, centralized autocracy, militarism, forcible suppression of opposition, belief in a natural social hierarchy. So certainly, in my experience, those are the kind of things that he thinks would work better in terms of running America. You know, again, back to this issue of, you know, democracy is complicated, messy to operate, probably the worst kind of government there is, except for all the other ones. I think Churchill once said that. And again, our Constitution, our founders built in to the Constitution and to the way our government operates, built in a lot of checks and balances, and didn't design the government to be streamlined and whatnot. So, but certainly, the former president is in the far right area. He's certainly an authoritarian. Admires people who are dictators. He has said that. So he certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, for sure.
And he wishes he had generals like Hitler, apparently. But what do you make of that? Does it matter? I don't think it does. I think he could literally shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. It's baked into the cake, as Governor Sununu said.
I think that the Harris campaign is a very data-driven campaign. I don't think they would go all in on these developments. We have, you know, Republican, you know, people who work for Trump on record saying he's a fascist, and Kelly's not even the only one at this point. I don't think they would go all in on it unless they had some evidence that did move the needle in some way. Having said that, I was struck in the discussion after the town hall on CNN with the attendees, where one of the criticisms made of Harris was that there's too much negativity. You talk about using schoolyard bully language, and they weren't just saying her; they're saying everybody does it. And so I think there is a risk in having Kamala do it. Just hurt. I mean, the campaign can't leave on the table people that work for Trump say he's a fascist. Like, you can't just let's not use that one. Like, it should be an ad. Tim Walz. I don't know if you saw Tim Walz's riff about Trump at McDonald's.
He missed an opportunity, though. Being at McDonald's, he looks much more like Ronald McDonald than the clown that he actually is. Tell me you don't see this one coming from a mile away. And Ronald wears less makeup. You saw it coming. You saw it coming. That restaurant wasn't even open. It was a stunt. Fake orders for fake customers. They even staged the drive-through. We know that. They won't let you walk through the damn drive-through. We knew that. They saw that happening. But look, everything about this guy is fake. Everything he does is fake. Next, he's going to be telling you he's a cop or a construction worker. Because he dances to the Village People, so he knows it's YMCA. And I'll tell you this, though. That 5 minutes he stood next to the deep fryer, I'll guarantee you that's the hardest that guy's ever worked in his life. And that's not a joke.
But it was fantastic. I feel it hasn't gotten that much attention because there's so much other stuff is going on. But Walz is a really good attack dog.
I know. I feel like they've been underutilizing him for a month now.
Well, I think he's been ramping up, but like, okay. I mean, vice presidents usually do get somewhat sidelined because you tend to focus on top of the ticket. If I was in the Harris campaign, if I was in the inner circle, I would say for these last 2 weeks, Kamala, don't even say Trump's name. I mean, I might even say it publicly. I'm going to turn the page on Donald Trump. I'm done talking about Donald Trump. Between now and Election Day, all you're going to hear from me is what I'm going to do for the country, how we're going to lift this up again. Let Tim Walz do it. Let Tim Walz. That's the classic relationship. The presidential yeah. candidate is optimistic and forward-looking, and the vice presidential nominee is the attack dog.
I think there was a saying that if you own a dog, you don't have to bite or you don't have to growl. Or I think right. that came to Spiro Agnew as Richard Nixon's attack dog. Something
so
like that.
So my sense is the data says it moves the needle, but maybe you want to leave that to other people to push to prosecute that case.
You mentioned something. You said that you think Harris's campaign is very data-driven. And I'm curious if you think this is a better run campaign. Now, obviously, the technology has become more sophisticated over the years. But if you think sort of pound for pound that this is a better run campaign, because, Hillary Clinton thought she didn't have to go to Wisconsin, because they thought this coalition of the ascendant, that demography was destiny. And they were using, I don't know if it was good data, but they were making assumptions based off of.
I mean, you can be data driven and still make mistakes. You can still misread data. You can overinterpret data.
Sure, you can. But my question is, do you have reason to believe or suspect that Kamala's campaign is a better run campaign than others?
Well, just to go back to the Hillary thing, I wrote a piece about this recently. Obviously, there's a lot of attention about her not going to Wisconsin, but there is evidence that was not a game changer. That campaign, we talked about on the show previously, that campaign stops generally don't move the needle. There are exceptions, not that they can never move the needle. But Donald Trump did a lot of campaigning in Colorado and Virginia in 2016 that didn't do a darn thing. So there's nothing magic about a campaign stop. But again, having said that, when you do have races that potentially could come down to a handful of votes and every little thing can potentially matter. I mean, one thing that a campaign rally can do is bring thousands of people into a room who you could sign up and get them to do some more door knocking for you. And maybe you can knock on a few more doors.
Forget the rally thing. I shouldn't have mentioned Wisconsin. Forget rallies. So Kamala has David Plouffe, right, who's a veteran of the Obama campaign. But he came in only a month, you know, because of the way that things went down. He hasn't been there that long. Do you believe that this is a better run, that they've got some secret sauce maybe that other campaigns didn't have?
I mean, I can't speak, you know, super knowledgeably. My sense is that they're probably running a little more scared than Hillary did. Like, Hillary didn't go to Wisconsin because she thought it would show weakness. It would make it seem like she was worried, and she didn't want to give off that, didn't want to contribute to that sort of narrative. And maybe it would have, you know, maybe it wouldn't have made it any difference.
I think she did go to Michigan like the last weekend. She did.
And even that raised a few eyebrows. Why is she going to Michigan? So you're not seeing the Harris campaign, you know, fall into that trap. And so in that respect, I think there's better body language there. And this is also a campaign that I think, you know, even pre-Kamala, from the Biden phase of the campaign, that assumed a nail-biter race and put a lot of energy into big ground game, thinking this might be what the difference is, which I don't presume the Hillary campaign, you know, thought it was going to be like that. So ground game is always a hard thing to fully assess from the outside, but we've talked about this many times before. All evidence is the Trump ground game is a disaster. And if it does come down to a few votes, that could be the difference. And that would argue that this is a better built campaign than the Hillary campaign was.
All right. So going back to the whole fascism thing, Tucker Carlson, my former boss, said something the other day, which concerns
this is yesterday.
Yeah. We're taping this on Thursday, so he said this on Wednesday.
Yeah.
I think there are hints of fascism in what he said. I mean, there's also
I'd say more than hints.
Well, it's sort of creepy. There's some sort of eroticism there. There's a lot of paternalism there. I'll play the clip and then we could talk about it.
If you allow your 2-year-old to smear the contents of his diapers on the wall of your living room and you do nothing about it, if you allow your 14-year-old to light a joint at the breakfast table, if you allow your hormone-addled 15-year-old daughter to like slam the door of her bedroom and give you the finger, you're gonna get more of it. And those kids are gonna wind up in rehab. It's not good for you and it's not good for them. No. There has to be a point at which dad comes home.
I love how they cheer
that. That's right.
That's the scary part.
Dad
the
comes
cheering.
Home. And he's pissed. Dad is pissed. He's not vengeful. He loves his children. Disobedient as they may be, he loves them. Because they're his children. They live in his house. But he's very disappointed in their behavior. And he's going to have to let them know. He's going to have to get to your room right now and think about what you did. And when dad gets home, you know what he says? You've been a bad girl. You've been a bad little girl and you're getting a vigorous spanking right now. And no, it's not going to hurt me more than it hurts you. No, it's not. I'm not going to lie. This is going to hurt you a lot more than it hurts me. And you earned this. You're getting a vigorous spanking because you've been a bad girl. And it has to be this way. It has to be this way because it's true. And you're only going to get better when you take responsibility for what you did. That's not said in the spirit of hate. It's not said in the spirit of vengeance or bigotry. Far from it. It's said in the spirit of justice, which is the purest and best thing there is. And without it, things fall apart.
So put aside the S&M references, you know, or allusions. The whole paradigm is that Donald Trump is your daddy, and
you didn't even get the whole where Trump says daddy's home. They did that whole part.
No, I missed that. Tell me about this.
Well, I well, you keep talking. I'll try to pull up the exact quote.
Okay. it's such a paternalistic notion that Trump is America's father, and we are all living in his house, and we are stupid kids who are misbehaving and being ornery and bad, and he needs no. He fucking works for us. He is a public servant. We, the people, run this country. He works for us, and we are not his children. And that metaphor is BS and disturbing. And if enough people believe it, then you end up with a dictator.
I'm sorry. It was when Trump got on the stage, the crowd chanted, "Daddy's home."
Yeah. There you go. And see, that's the thing. They love it. Mm-hmm. They want daddy. They want someone. They want a powerful, strong man
control. In that room, this is why I have a hard time saying that Trump's going to win. I do not believe this is what most Americans want. Now, it may be, if he does win, that there is that middle-of-the-road voter that isn't aware of it, looks away from it, rationalizes it. Oh, that's not really going to happen. But I don't think the majority wants this.
They don't, but they don't know. They don't know about this, or they think it's funny if they hear about it, or it. Bill, I watched Fox and Friends the other morning, and it was when Trump went to this barber shop, and he was hanging out, and I'm like, I'm 5 minutes away from voting for Trump at this point. I mean, he was great. It was great. If you watch Fox News, which half the country apparently does, you don't know about this. And it's just, they do not see this. And if they do see it, it's shown in the most flattering light, and all the libs are all worked up in a tizzy over this. We're just trolling. It's all funny. We're just trolling the libs. And yeah. And of course, the other unspoken thing here is that the good people are the good kids. They're not going to get punished, of course. The good kids, us, the people watching this, the people in the audience, we're the good kids. We're going to get rewarded by daddy. It's those bad kids who are smoking weed and smearing feces. Well, technically, I think the last time I checked, the people who do that are January 6th rioters. But you get my point. It's about those people. That's what fascism is. Well,
what you just, the clip you just showed, I mean, it's one of the most disturbing, Orwellian, fascist, violent, sexist. I mean, it's one of the worst utterances I think I've heard in the realm of politics in my life. Everything about it is upside down and disturbing. This is a movement that has excused insurrectionism.
Yeah,
the claims of the Law and Order Party, yet encourages disorder.
It's infantilizing voters and American citizens, and it's elevating a politician to be our parent. It's patently unconservative, among many, many, many other things.
Look, this goes back to what I say about what does Kamala do with this? On one hand, this is so disturbing. We talk about this on many, many shows. Trump throws you off your game. You would love to just talk about positive things and what you bring to the table and what your plan for the country is. But then you see something that is so deeply abhorrent that you can't just ignore it and pretend that it's not there. So how do you address that without totally undercutting, your strongest points? So I think the way to do that is to separate what Kamala does and what the rest of the campaign does. But this is the challenge for the closing days. Now you know Tucker Carlson. We've thought this many, many times. And I hate to put you on the spot all the time. But I feel like for a long time I was like, well, that's just Tucker. Tucker is kind of a lovable rogue. I don't agree with this, but he's a good guy. When you see this, what goes through your mind?
It's super. I mean, so obviously it's super dangerous. I just wish I had something insightful to say. It's so weird that, like, I've known Tucker for many years. I worked for him for 6 years. Spent a lot of time hanging out with him. I've been to lunch with him. I've been to his house. And yet I don't have anything insightful to say. He was a great boss.
This doesn't resemble the guy that you hung out with. Is that fair to say?
He looks the same. He sounds the same. He used to say things like this, but we took it as like a joke or him just, you know, being outrageous for the sake of, he would say outrageous things. But yet I never truly believed that he was demented to this degree. And look, he was paying me to write whatever I wanted to write, which I'm pretty much the same as I was then in many regards, in many respects. And he ran an office that was not dictatorial at all. It was do whatever you want. Like, hey, let a million flowers bloom. We don't have to agree. It's his ethos as the boss was the opposite of authoritarian. So I wish I just, it's so, I think it's just anticlimactic when people bring up that I knew him, and I wish I had an insight, but I just don't. It's weird. And so many people, you know, every time I go to dinners or, you know, events with people who knew him better than I did and are more prominent than me, nobody knows. This is the number one topic of conversation and nobody has a good answer.
Can I bring you back to the Bronx Barbershop event?
Please.
So I wrote a piece about this. And I, because all this fascist stuff is, you know, demands our attention. There's other crazy things that Trump says that don't get any attention at all, because they're not as incendiary, but I do think deserve attention. Excuse me, I'm trying to pull up, you know, actual
and
quotes.
Bill, here, while you're looking for that, I'm trying to remember. So there was some report that came out that the judge in Florida, who has basically been slow walking the documents case and making sure
killed it.
Yeah, she finally did kill it, right?
Effectively. I mean, it's being appealed, but her ruling is this should be thrown out.
And something came out that she was being offered a position in the administration or something. Did you see this?
I did not see that. Okay. Totally unsurprising.
Okay. So obviously I'm not entirely up to speed on the details here, but just let me say, in a different world, that would have been earth-shattering news, okay?
Yeah.
You didn't even hear about it, Bill.
Yeah.
And I'm obviously not up to speed with the details. Why? Because there's so many, like, Trump says so many crazy and chaotic things, and there's so many bizarre things that are happening that we don't even, we can't, the human, you know, our nervous system is not equipped to deal with being on high alert for 9 years. We cannot handle it. We cannot consume the fire hose. Okay.
So in the Bronx Barbershop event, one of the attendees asked Trump, is there a way that we could eventually eliminate federal taxes? The way he phrases, like, what?
Actually, I saw this one. I saw the whole thing. I watched the whole thing. Yeah.
So Trump's response was, and it's not like he had, like, think about it. It wasn't like he was, like, groping for words. It wasn't a word salad where it's like, oh, I'm trying to figure out what my answer is going to be. Like, he had his answer right there. There is a way. You know, in the old days when we were smart, when we were a smart country in the 1890s and all, this is when the country was relatively the richest it ever was. It had all tariffs. It didn't have an income tax, okay? Now we have income taxes. We have people that are dying. They're paying tax, and they don't have the money to pay the tax. You know, in the old days, 1890, 1880, we had so much money. They had to set up committees, blue ribbon committees, how to spend our wealth. We had no idea how to spend it. It was so much money. Then we went to the income tax system, and the rest is sort of history. Now, as you know, Matt, I'm not one to let a historic reference go unexplained. But we're literally talking about the Gilded Age. We're talking about a time in American history where inequality was massive. So yeah, there were some people who were very rich. There were the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and the I'm forgetting. J.P. Morgan. But you had plenty of people who were barely scraping by. In the 1890s, you had a four-year, what was called at the time, the Great Depression. The nation wasn't all living it up. There were plenty of people who were, you know, dying of starvation. Unemployment was estimated to be 20%.
They didn't call it like a downturn or a panic. They called it
They called it the Great Depression. I mean, now it's referred to as the Panic of 1893, but it actually was a four-year economic depression. And yes, the nation was living with the government was largely funded through tariffs, had been for a long time. And in 1890, there was the McKinley tariff. Now, McKinley wasn't president yet. He was in the Congress, but he was known as like the tariff expert for the Republican Party. The Republican Party, you know, it was born as the anti-slavery party in the 1850s with Lincoln in the 1860s. But then the Civil War ended and slavery was abolished. And then the party changed what it became known for. And the policy position it was most known for was the protective tariff. And that's because it was a Northern party and heavily influenced by Northern business interests. It wasn't the agrarian populist party. It was the business-oriented party. And they were protecting those businesses, even though it meant elevated prices on a lot of consumers. And a lot of farmers didn't like it. So you had this, and so you had a big tariff increase in 1890 from what was already high. Yeah, and so Trump, what I think Trump's referring to there in terms of like having so much money, there was a big surplus in the late 1880s, 1890s. And this is when the Republican president was Benjamin Harrison. And so they ended up with what was called the $1 billion Congress. It was the first Congress to pass a budget that spent more than $1 billion in peacetime. And they jacked up tariffs while doing it. Guess what? The people didn't like higher prices and record levels of government spending. And Democrats had a fantastic 1890 midterm. They blew out Republicans in the House. And then they won the White House and the Senate in 1892. And after that, you had this big depression. The Democrats actually tried to do a tariff reform in 1894, but the Senate was still pretty influenced by the business lobby, and it didn't really reduce tariffs much at all, which made people, you know, angry all over again. But you also have these William Jennings Bryan and their populists were considered too radical. McKinley becomes president in 1896. They jack up tariffs even more. And at this point, the Republican Party is making more and more, the country is expanding to the West. Republicans are getting more Western agrarians in their coalition, and they don't like the tariffs. And so Teddy Roosevelt in the early 1900s was like, our party's divided over this. I don't want to get into it. Taft follows Roosevelt. He says, you know, I'm going to be, you know, a good policy guy. We got to do something about these tariffs. So he tries to do a tariff reform. It's kind of a bulky mess. No one likes it. Everyone's mad at both sides. But it does include the constitutional amendment to create income tax. So I missed one part of the story. I apologize. Yeah. When Grover Cleveland's Democrats in 1894 did a tariff reform, they included income tax in it, but it was struck down by the Supreme Court. Even back then, they knew. I mean, they had a House floor debate where the Democrats in the House Ways and Means Committee laid out the unfairness of the system. This is from a book I have here called The Great Tax Wars by Stephen Weissman. This is a great book, by the way. It's not just 1890s. It covers a lot of ground. So I'm quoting from that book here. He was describing the House debate in 1894. A tiny handful of this was from census data at the time. A tiny handful of persons owned over one half of the wealth in the United States, while 1/60th owned over 2/3 of the wealth. On the lower end of the scale, the table showed that 3/4 of American families were not worth more than $600 for all members. The tariff was seen in this context for what it was, a tax that exaggerated the basic economic inequalities among Americans. The Ways and Means Committee's breakdown thus demonstrated that poor families paid taxes in the form of higher prices due to tariffs on dishes, cups, forks, clothing, indeed, quote, everything except water and air, unquote. Hmm. This is the America that Donald Trump is literally saying we should return to. This is when we were smart, when we were wealthy. We should do it this way. That is insane. End of lecture.
And he didn't even get into Smoot-Hawley, folks. That's down the road. So, all right, my friend, good show. And I guess next week, is it next week when we will presumably make our state predictions?
Unless you punk out.
All right. I'm just going to pop a Xanax and go to 270 to win. And we will see you back here in the DMZ next week. See you, Bill.
Take care.